Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. On today's show, Jan Grew, on his new memoir, I Live a Life Like Yours. Jan Grew was born in 1981 in Oslo. The author of a wide-ranging body of work in fiction, non-fiction, children's books and academic literature, he is also professor of sociology at the University of Oslo. His memoir, I Live a Life Like Yours, was published in Norway in 2018 and has been hailed as a major milestone in Norwegian non-fiction. It is the first Norwegian non-fiction book to be nominated for the Nordic Council's Literature Prize in 50 years. And it's now been translated into English by B.L. Crook, and I'm talking to Jan today about it. Jan, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
So tell us, first of all, what was your aim with this book?
Oh, that's a good question. It took me, I would say, around 10 years to write it. So it's hard to talk about aims because they change over time. And the book evolved quite a lot from the sort of the first early sketches, which were, I think, memories, really. I mean, the book is a memoir, but the transformative event for me was a while after I'd become a father. I got an archive of sorts from my parents. They wanted to know whether I would like to have to take from them various records from my childhood, medical records, letters that had gone to and from doctors, welfare services, and so on. I sat down to read those papers, which were a story about my childhood, one that I didn't really recognize or remember. And so I think one of the aims for me with the book was to try and work out how two very different stories about my childhood could be true. The things that I remembered and the things that were written down, which, you know, were so very different.
So what we haven't mentioned so far is you were diagnosed at 3 years old with spinal muscular atrophy. So tell us, in the most basic terms, what that means.
Well, it's a good question with a long answer, but I'll try to put it in the simplest way possible. My muscles are weak. I was a child that started walking relatively early, but I also fell down quite a lot. And so my parents grew worried, increasingly worried over time. The diagnosis I got at age 3 was for a very rare genetic condition. It was made on the basis of a muscular biopsy. That's what they did back then, was basically to look at part of the muscle fibers and then make an educated clinical guess about the sort of the underlying condition. And so I lived with that diagnosis for a number of years, for more than 20 years. And it never quite fit. And when genetic testing became more precise, when the technology had evolved, it turned out that diagnosis was wrong. I didn't have spinal muscular atrophy at all. I had a different condition, which was only became clear years after that again. But that diagnosis was nevertheless the label or the category, if you will, that I grew up with, and that was used to, you know, explain me in a clinical sense. And so that was a very strange experience too, to read those papers and to know that a lot of what was said in very confident, very precise clinical language was wrong still.
And so one of the key changes of that diagnosis, the later diagnosis, was that spinal muscular dystrophy is a progressive disease. And at the time, everybody was convinced that you would progressively get worse. That didn't happen. So when that new diagnosis happened, how did that change your own psychological relationship with your body?
Yeah. No, I mean, it was just a strange way to grow up. I mean, I as I said, I was always a weak child, and I grew weaker as I grew bigger because my muscles didn't keep up. So I started using a wheelchair at around the time I was 8 and was able to walk for shorter and shorter distances until a point probably in my late teens where things stabilized more or less. And the diagnosis implied that I would keep growing weaker. As you say, SMA can be a progressive condition. But there was always this sort of this sense of divergence between what was supposed to happen in my body and what actually happened. And fortunately, I had a very good doctor who was a friend of the family, a medical geneticist, who told my parents that these diagnoses are often imprecise. And we really shouldn't trust them too much. He knew that there was so much uncertainty involved. But even so, a diagnosis can be a very influential thing. I mean, it tells you what's going on with your body, what you can expect. And so I lived with that sense of something being off, something being wrong, which I think I've described elsewhere as being like being in a suit that doesn't fit you, like being in ill-fitting clothes. So just having that diagnosis disappear, which happened around the time I was 25, 26, was both a great relief and a sense of profound uncertainty of biographical disruption. So after that, I had to think about what my expectations for the future would be. And I think probably that was around the time that I started writing what eventually became this book, trying to get a sense of my life story in a different way. And definitely in a non-clinical, non-medical way.
There's another writer in the book that I'd like to introduce here, acts as a sort of talisman throughout the book, the poet Mark O'Brien. Can you tell us something about who he is and why he features in the book?
Yeah. So Mark O'Brien was a poet, among other things, who lived for much of his life in Berkeley in California, which is a place that is where I've lived as well, and a place that remains very important to me. He's written beautifully on his experience of disability, on vulnerable embodiment. He was also, physically speaking, much, much weaker than I was, than I am. And so it was important for me, I think, both to engage with the writing of other disabled authors and to remember that my experience of disability is not necessarily the most challenging one there is. I'm not saying other people are worse off than me, because that's not what I'm trying to get across. But there are things in Mark O'Brien's experiences that I think make for a useful contrast with mine and a reminder of the kind of solidarity that can be found in vulnerability as well.
So I mentioned in the introduction that you were born in 1981. Throughout the book, you include excerpts of, you know, medical reports. And at one point, you're described by a doctor as having very good capability. And what happens is it's decided that you will go to an ordinary school and you will be surrounded by other children. And that's how your education will proceed. And I wanted to talk about to what extent being born at that particular point in time dictated what happened next in terms of your education, and particularly in terms of the fact that, you know, 10 years earlier, things would have been worse, and presumably now, hopefully, they're a little better. So how did being born at that particular time affect you, and what happened subsequently?
Yes, that's a very good question. I think a lot of what you say rings true. I was born at a particular historical moment, as we all are. And had I been born 10 years earlier, it's far from certain that I would have gone to an ordinary school, because the education system in Norway, as elsewhere, has changed over time and has moved towards at least a greater degree of disability inclusion and accommodation. And at the same time, I'm writing a story about my particular family circumstances. I grew up with parents who are and were very resourceful and committed and politically aware people who fought for these things and for many other things during my childhood and my teenage years. And so both my family background and the historical moment, I think, speaks to what we often forget, which is that disability is a deeply historical thing. It tends to be thought of in many situations as something ahistorical, as something that lives in individual bodies. It's understood, it's construed as a deficit in individual bodies. And that simply isn't true. What the thing that we call disability is a function of specific historical circumstances, specific societal circumstances, and of the nexus of family, class, ethnicity, gender, various other things come together to shape disability. And that's a recurring theme in my book, that the reductionism that is inherent to clinical medicine, it's been very important to me to get away from that, to provide more context.
And you talk about on a wider level how having a disability means a lifelong relationship with authorities, both medical but also social services, for instance. So tell us how that relationship has changed over the course of your life.
Well, I mean, for me, of course, the relationship is ongoing, and it changes with the social roles that I occupy. So right now, of course, a lot of these things are influenced by just the fact that I'm a parent. And I think that to an extent, certainly in Norway and possibly in the, in a lot of other countries as well, it's easier when talking about disabled people to envision either a disabled child or a disabled person living alone. It's much more difficult to see a parent who is also disabled. And I think that's a legacy of a lot of historical factors. I mean, of course, the Victorian charity discourse and, every sort of story from A Christmas Carol going forwards will gives us some frameworks and some mental images of disabled children like Tiny Tim. But we have fewer images and fewer concepts of disabled people who are also fully involved parents, citizens, disabled people in employment, and so on. Now, those social roles, of course, bring with them a lot of complexities, just in trying to work out the logistics of everyday life. And I've found that there's often a disjunct there between what we expect disabled people to be, the kind of services that are actually provided. We haven't come as far in those areas as we should.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thank you.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Jan Gru, and we're talking about his memoir, I Live a Life Like Yours. And Jan, I want to bring a couple of other writers in, Michel Foucault being the perhaps more famous one, but also the writer Rosemary Garland Thompson. And you talk in the book about their work on ideas around the gaze, around both the medical and clinical gaze, and maybe just on a more prosaic terms, just being stared at.
Yes. One of the things I try to do in the book is not use the word disability over much. I try to get as close as possible to my very particular experiences of being a body with weak muscles, number of other things I talk about in the book. I didn't want to draw too much on the sort of the relatively abstract concept of disability. There are more than a billion disabled people in the world, and it can be a very flattening category sometimes. But I did want to draw on a lot of the things that have been thought about disability, that have been written about disability. And so somebody like Rosemary Garland Thompson, who is an American feminist and philosophical scholar of disability, her writings on the gaze and on being stared at became important references for me in writing the book, because she'd written and thought some things that were so clear and precise that I didn't really need to work them out for myself. It felt like a much more natural thing to do, to quote her words on the subject and then use my own responses to those words. So Rosemary, who is a friend, writes about disabled people's experiences of being professional starees. And what she means by that is that a lot of us are very, very used to being stared at. We look unusual when moving about in the world, whether it is because we're using wheelchairs or because of other things. And so that is a social experience that is always with us. We expect to be stared at, and we expect having to negotiate with people who stare at us. It's always a decision that I have to make, whether to meet somebody's gaze, whether to look away, whether to confront them silently, even with the fact that they are staring at me or not. That's a way of being in the world that I can't really ignore. So there's always this layer of consciousness, this sort of layer of reflexivity that I have with me when moving around in the world. You mentioned Michel Foucault as well. His writings on the gaze they have to do with something that's a little bit different from that. It's his writings on the clinical gaze and the way that this can make you feel like an object in many ways. The way that the medical way of seeing, thinking, talking is conducive to a very objective way of construing the body, which can make it quite difficult, if you grow up under this gaze, to develop a sense of subjectivity, to develop an identity that is not connected to objecthood in a way.
And this is also related to the work of the writer Irving Goffman that you talk about in the book on stigma.
Yes, Goffman is of course, was one of the preeminent sociologists of his generation, and he was an extremely acute observer of micro interactions, that's the term of art, the way in which social reality is made in a million different social encounters. And stigma was one of his key topics, where he wrote about the way in which physical, visible aspects of people are used to impute some sort of moral blame. Stigma in the etymological sense was a way of branding runaway slaves in classical Greece. So a mark on the body was used to convey moral blame. And much of the same logic is of course at work in the modern world, just in the way that, say, bad teeth can carry an imputation of moral stigma. You've done something wrong. You've eaten too much sugar. That applies to a lot of other things that have to do with the body. And I find it interesting the degree to which shame is a factor in the lives of a lot of people with disabilities, with chronic illnesses. They have a sense not just of having done something wrong, but of being wrong in a sense, of not having the right to be out in the world, that their mere existence is perceived as shameful. And so I try to untangle some of the reasons why that is the case, what it is in society that conveys this sense of deep existential shame.
You also, I think, write very interestingly about your ongoing evolving relationship, intimate relationship with your wheelchair. Tell us something about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, I think it's something that a lot of wheelchair users will find obvious and that a lot of non-wheelchair users find utterly surprising, which is that the fact that if you use a wheelchair every day, as I do, it becomes part of your body in a very real sense. There have actually been psychological studies on this, that the proprioception, the sense of where your body begins and ends for wheelchair users and for, you know, people who use canes to get a tactile sense of the world, in a very real sense, that the sense of your own body extends to encompass the wheelchair. And for me, that also means that when somebody leans on the wheelchair, thinks of it or uses it like an object and not as a part of my body, I get very, very uncomfortable. That is, of course, because I depend utterly on this object for moving around in the world. I'm vulnerable just in the sort of the fundamental sense that if I get a flat tire, I'm stuck. I can't move around until somebody helps me, until I get a different wheelchair in place, until the tire is fixed. And that shapes my entire, a very large range of how I interact with the world. It also means that if I go traveling, if I fly on an airplane, I of course have to send the wheelchair as cargo. And for the duration of the flight, it will be impossible for me not to worry about whether the wheelchair will arrive in one piece. Because it is in a very specific sense, as though I've had to send one of my limbs as cargo. And I won't feel complete until I'm reattached to it.
Well, I wanted to talk about a couple of instances, good and bad, of travel, of experiences of travel over your lifetime. Tell us something about your experiences of being a student on exchanges to St. Petersburg and Amsterdam.
Yeah, now I included those passages in the book because I wanted to give it a little bit more of a sense of seeing that I grew up in a very well-functioning welfare state, all things considered. Norway is far, far from perfect, but it does have one of the most generous welfare states in the world, with nothing like the degree of austerity that has been practiced in the UK, for example. And so I wanted to include my experiences of studying in the Netherlands, in the United States, and in Russia as just a way of providing more context. And Russia for me was a very difficult place to be, because accessibility, and certainly back around the turn of the century, was terrible, was almost absent. And so being there was a reminder of the things that, after all, did work back home, but also of my limitations in moving around the world. I mean, I grew up in an academic household with all of the resources and privileges that made it natural for me to start and complete a university education. So I did have that class privilege. But at the same time, I had some extremely strict limitations because of being a wheelchair user that made going to Russia as a student of Russian an incredibly steep challenge. After having studied Russian at university for a year, I realized that I could not realistically pursue that direction further because it would simply not be possible for me to spend as much time in that country as I would need to. And so I wanted to get a sense of the boundaries, the very strict boundaries that have surrounded my privileges as well. There's that balance between resources, privileges, and vulnerability that has been a very important part of my life.
And I wanted to talk about, you've already mentioned Berkeley, but your relationship with California and Berkeley in particular. And I wasn't aware until reading your book of the part that Berkeley had played in disabled activism in the past.
Yes. So that again, that was the sort of the sense of a wider world of disability that I wanted to at least hint at in the book. I first went to Berkeley in 2005, I think it was, and then I spent a year there in 2008, 2009. And I sought Berkeley out because I knew something about that history of disability activism. And it was important for me to go there to get a sense of that culture. And it didn't disappoint. Of course, the United States is a terrible country to be disabled in because of the lack of welfare services and public support. But it is also home to an incredibly rich cultural and activist tradition in the disability field that started to emerge in the 1960s. There was a history prior to that, but it really came into full flower in the 1970s, with some very interesting historical connections to the civil rights movement, to the Black Panthers even. And so I wanted to learn more about that and found that to be a history that was then not very broadly known. There have been popularizations and very interesting stories that have been more broadly told over the years. The film Crip Camp, distributed through Netflix, was a watershed moment in that regard. But there's still so much that hasn't been talked about in wider circles. The historian Paul Longmore, who worked in the Bay Area for many years, I was fortunate enough to meet him before he died, wrote that the history of disability is a hidden history. And that is still true to a very great extent.
How did becoming a father change your perspective on your own life?
Well, it changed everything. I mean, I think that is true for a lot of new parents, specifically in terms of a lot of the things I write about in the book. It was transformative for me just to see that is something that could happen to me. That is something that I was never sure would happen. And just being able to be a father, to see that I was actually able to fulfill that role, was maybe the greatest gift I've ever been given.
And just one more thing. There's a rather melancholy idea that runs through the book, which is the idea that out of the corner of your eye, always not quite present, is the possibility of an unlived life, how things might have been different.
Yeah, I think that's something that haunts the lives of a lot of disabled people. And it speaks to diagnosis again. It's the sort of the notion that but for this thing, there would have been, I don't know what, a better life, a more fulfilled life. Again, it's this cultural notion that disability is a kind of deficit that must be made up for in one way or another. And there are so many stories told about disability in the wider culture, in films and books, that are either about magical cure or about death, also as a kind of cure in a way. This is something that comes to us from so many angles. And so I wanted to acknowledge that cultural story is there, but to also try to write the book as an antidote to that, to try to engage with, but also to try and perform a kind of verbal jujitsu on the medical language, the clinical and diagnostic language, and to try to integrate it into what I wanted to be my own story, told in a literary way, but with all of the sociological and philosophical quotations that I wanted to include, to try to make it something that would be my own.
So I've been talking to Jan Gru. We've been talking about his memoir, I Live a Life Like Yours, which is translated into English from Norwegian by B.L. Crook and is out in the UK from Pushkin Press. Jan, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us.
Thank you, Neil. It's been a pleasure.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.